Cincinnati Edition on a Sunday morning. I'm Mark Purcell. Outreach astronomer from the Cincinnati Observatory Center and regular Cincinnati Edition contributor Dean Regas is in the studio this morning, looking up with UC professor Mike Sitko.
Well, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Well, now, recently I went to one of your talks about planetary formation, and I was struck by the newness of discoveries. I mean, it seems like we're having these ideas now of how planets are forming around other stars, and it's all different from what I learned when I was a kid.
Yeah, it's sort of interesting in the sense that some of the ideas we've been dealing with, like the nebular theory, are really at least a century old now, but a lot of the details are still kind of a mystery, and what we're trying to do now is to get a handle on where it is that planets are forming. You know, if you make a survey of the exoplanets orbiting other stars, we know that there, for example, are these massive Jupiter-like planets that are really, really, really close to their host stars, like closer than Mercury is to our sun. And we don't think that they form there. And so they probably had to form elsewhere and then migrate to their current locations.
So those are the so-called hot Jupiters.
Yeah,
that's one of my favorite terms in planetary science.
Yeah, we think that planets like Jupiter really probably had to form in regions where it was cold enough for ice to add to the mass of the planet, because ice is potentially the most abundant solid there is in the universe, just because hydrogen and oxygen are so abundant compared to the things that make rocks, for example. And so in our own solar system, that is at least out beyond the orbit of Mars, the current orbit of Mars. And so if these other planetary systems formed in pretty much the same way, those planets had to move a considerable distance.
And so we look at our solar system and we think, all right, now when I was a kid, you know, I was taught the order of the planets, but
right.
The saying, my
right.
Very educated mother just served us, well, nachos now.
Right.
And so apparently that wasn't how it was, the order of the planets.
Yeah, the funny thing is, scientists who've actually looked at how the planets' orbits evolve over time have come to the realization that it's quite possible for planets to migrate considerable distances and even swap places. And there's a model called the Nice model, after the observatory at Nice in France, where the astronomers have been looking at this thing, doing numerical simulations for the past couple of years. And in many of these simulations, Uranus and Neptune actually swap places due to gravitational interactions with each other and as well as with other small bodies out in the solar system.
So in the past, Neptune was closer than Uranus.
And that actually makes a little bit of sense, because Neptune's actually a little more massive and a little bit bigger than Uranus is. It also has an internal heat source, which Uranus doesn't. So Neptune's a little bit more like Jupiter and Saturn than Uranus is.
But we don't need to worry about our inner rocky planets switching places or anything like that.
No, we're pretty stable right now. But, you know, if you were to, let's say, study the motion of, let's say, Mercury 5 billion years into the future, it might be wandering around a little bit. But Earth is probably not going to wander too far from where it is right now.
And so now we can see, in quotes, other planets around other stars now.
Yeah.
And we're finding these kind of new dynamics in the planet formation around other stars. Tell me a little bit more about what you found.
Well, one of the things that we've been doing is looking at really young systems that are probably right in the planet forming stage. And we think that planets form out of disks of gaseous material and little solid particles that we call dust. And when the planets form, they sweep up large swaths of this stuff and they actually open up a gap inside of these disks. And what we're doing now is investigating the regions right around these gaps, and we're finding some really interesting things. In one object we looked at recently, we found what appeared to be spiral arms, like a pinwheel galaxy kind of a shape. And the people who study planet formation at these early stages tell us that that kind of a formation is likely the result of two Jupiter-like mass planets inside the gap. We haven't seen the planets yet, but we think we've seen their effects.
So it's swirls of, spirals, not like in, you know, rings that, like we picture the orbits of the planets.
No, it's actually, there's a trailing arm that leads to the outer part of the gap, and then a leading arm which leads to the inner part of the gap. And it's basically where the planet is sweeping up the material from the edges of the gap.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really cool.
And so you get to have the unenviable task of going to Hawaii to study these things, right? You go to the big island of Hawaii.
Life is tough, but somebody has to do it.
Yes, we do.
One of the things that we have to do in astronomy is to try and find the best astronomical sites. And for a lot of things, the top of Mauna Kea in Hawaii is one of the best places in the world for a couple of different reasons. One is the air turbulence is minimized compared to most other sites. So the twinkling of stars and the blurring of stars when you take images or other observations is minimized as much as you can naturally. And for doing the sorts of objects that we do a lot of observations at infrared wavelengths, wavelengths longer than what the human eye can see. And unfortunately, in that part of the electromagnetic spectrum, water vapor is something that blocks off much of the light, okay? And so we try to get as above as much of the water vapor as we can, and Mauna Kea is a great place to do that.
And so you, what telescopes do you get to work on there? And then you go up to the mountain, which is how high up is it?
It's almost 14,000 feet. Yeah.
And then so you can go up at night to do your work
right.
And then go down the beach during the day, right?
Well, not exactly. Usually we go down to a dormitory facility where we eat and sleep, and that's at 9,000 feet.
Ah, okay. Down a little bit.
Yeah, down a little bit. And we're not really allowed to stay at the summit for long periods of time just because it's so hard on the human body.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm speaking with Dr. Mike Sitko, professor of physics at the University of Cincinnati. And, you know, other than being envious of you guys going to Hawaii all the time, you're also education. And astronomers really need to be writers and communicators nowadays, too.
Exactly. I mean, we have to do the best job we can at conveying to the public all the wonders that the universe really has to offer us. And do it in a sensible way. I mean, a lot of people can get really stuck off in the details and things like that. But the universe is a really, really exciting place. And presented in the right way, you can get the average person excited about what's happening in the sky.
And so what are your students? You know, you teach them all these different topics in astronomy. What kind of grabs them that you've noticed recently?
Well, it depends on the group that I'm working with. I've been teaching off and on, of course, the introductory astronomy courses to freshmen and sophomores, and there, lots of different things really catch their imagination. Things like cosmology, life in the universe are always favorite topics. The rest of the students that I've been teaching are actually undergraduate physics and astrophysics majors. And there we actually teach them observational techniques, the physics of stars and galaxies and quasars and cosmology and you name it.
So can you remember that moment for you when, you know, astronomy got hold of you? Do you have a origin story as an astronomer?
Well, it started with me as a kid, actually, and I was always interested in astronomy. I used to go to the library and check out books on astronomy and read them. But it wasn't really until I was graduating from high school that I realized that I can actually get a career in doing astrophysics and astronomy.
It's surprising,
and,
isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it was really surprising to me, and I've enjoyed it ever since.
Well, now your other field of research is comets. You've been
right.
You know, studying comets in the past, and we have a doozy coming up, right? I hope.
Well, we hope so. Comet Ison is coming, and we don't know exactly how bright it's going to be. Comets are kind of fickle and unpredictable, as we've learned since the days of Comet Kohoutek back in the 1970s. But there's every indication that this object is going to be one of the brightest that we've seen in many, many decades.
And this is Ison, I-S-O-N, and
yeah.
This isn't named after a person,
no,
is it?
No, it's named after a project, I think, so, yeah.
So what are you hoping to study with this comet coming by?
Well, we're trying to figure out exactly what our solar system was like when it formed. And to do that, we have to find the most pristine, least processed material that's left over from the formation, and that's basically the comets. And so we like to study as many comets as we can, find out what we can about the gases that are being given off by the comets, find out, in my case, what the mineral content of the dust particles in the comets are, because that gives us clues as to how our planetary system actually formed very, very early on, 4.5 billion years ago. So what we're doing is we're going to be getting some images, we're getting some spectra, breaking the light down into its constituent wavelengths, because we can actually figure out the mineral content of the dust grains that way. And there's even a plan to use some ground-based telescopes and the Hubble telescope to make polarization measurements.
So you're going to get some time on Hubble.
Yes, we already have time.
Exciting.
Yeah, yeah. May 7th, we're going to try our first observation and then continue that in the fall when the comet's going to be a lot brighter.
How do you get time on Hubble? What's the process?
Well, you have to get a team together, plan out the observation in agonizing detail, and then submit a proposal. And it usually is going through a referee process. We have two or three proposals that are going through the regular referees process, but this particular one, we directly asked the director of the observatory for just a little snippet of time in May, and it was granted within a day of our request.
Well, thanks so much for speaking with us this morning.
Sure.
I've been talking to Dr. Mike Sitko from the UC Physics Department. For more information, visit our website, wvxu.org. For Cincinnati Edition, I'm Dean Regas, looking up.